Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hello and welcome back to Pod on the Tyne. My name's Taylor Payne and I'm delighted to be joined by George Corkin and Chris Woff on this post-Champions League day. How the devil are you, George Corkin?
Yeah, I'm very well. Rather jealous that I wasn't at St. James's last night. I'm having a few days off. I ran the Paris half marathon on Sunday. Lovely. In my marathon training campaign. That went okay, but yeah, missed out. Missed out on that match. What a game to miss, blimey.
Chris, how are you?
Yes, I'm not too bad, thank you. Sleep deprived, but yeah, still got this sort of adrenaline from last night. It was one of those nights that you were delighted to have been at St. James's Park for, even if it was tinged with a slight degree of regret and disappointment at the very end.
Well, yes, last night was quite something, wasn't it? And with the match broadcast live via Amazon Prime in the UK, viewers were treated to some bozo talking rubbish and trying not to fall down the Leezer's End steps.
This is not just a game of football. This is passion. This is the noise. Dan Byrne towering over PSG. Craig Bellamy at the death in Rotterdam. Keith Gillespie whipping it in for Tino. All fuel for this Geordie fire. This is St. James's Park. Newcastle United in the last 16 of the Champions League. Power in the lads!
My God.
It's Pound Shop King Harry, that, wasn't it? Well, Geordie Jeans King Harry.
Is that the new intro to the pod?
Well, this isn't just football. This
is expensive. On our extra time service, Chris and Jacob were talking, and they were speculating at the end whether I would have cried watching that performance. And I tell you what, I did cry watching that performance, Taylor. Yeah. Good grief.
Well, you know, the first time I ever did live television, that, and probably the last, I'm going to be perfectly honest with you.
No, it was great. It was really great. It was good.
Listen, it was good fun. I didn't have a clue until about 2 minutes before it happened if it was actually going to go ahead or not because of the timings and stuff. I'm going to say it was possibly the most terrifying thing I've ever done in my life, but at the same time, a real experience. I promised myself this year as a New Year's resolution, I would say yes to more things. And I said yes to that. And then when I was stood on them steps, I thought, what the fuck am I doing?
Seeing your life literally in front of your eyes in case you went off of a tittle.
Tumbling down the stairs. Oh, no. Yeah. And the game has had to be, start of the game has been delayed and it was all captured on. And he's receiving treatment on the side of the pitch.
I really should have ended it with, I'm Johnny Knoxville and welcome to Jackass, shouldn't I? Just went over the barrier. That would have been good. Anyway, yeah, all of that shit aside, let's do some quick headlines, chaps, and we'll get into this. Chris Woff, Newcastle, almost at Barcelona 26 to Barcelona 97.
Yes, so much of the coverage leading up to the game was about Newcastle United 1997, Tino Asprilla's famous hat-trick, that victory, the only time Newcastle have beaten Barcelona, and having had the better of the match all the way through. Harvey Barnes scores in the 86th minute. Looks like it's going to be another famous night. And then right at the very death, a penalty is awarded and Lamine Yamal makes it 1-1 after the first leg of this Champions League round of 16 tie.
Yes, and we'll get back into that in a little bit. George, the Lasses are finally back in action this weekend. And we've an interview from inside the camp coming up.
We do indeed, yeah. It feels like it's been forever since they last had a match. It's actually a month. They play Sheffield United this weekend. And yeah, we've spoken to Gemma Purfield talking about this kind of weird season so far and looking ahead towards the run-in with it all still to play for.
And finally, Chris, men's season ticket prices rise again.
Yeah, controversial move that hasn't been well received. Above inflation, 5% rise, the fourth year in a row that tickets prices have gone up by 5%. And at some parts of the ground, if you're in sort of some of the bars, that's actually gone up 15%. The family section, family enclosure has also been reduced in size. And so, yeah, moved by David Hopkinson, who has been upfront about it and said that he wants to be transparent, but has used SCR, squad cost rules, as a reasoning for this. And I think moving forward, we shall see whether that is justified, whether Newcastle fans should be the ones and fans of football clubs should be the ones paying for these moving forward. But yeah, unfortunately, people during a cost of living crisis having to pay more towards their season tickets again next year.
Headlines in brief, Chris. I have to, come on.
30 seconds or more.
In brief. Come on, Chris. I mean, it's not the first time. It's not the first time I've had to have a go at you this. In brief. Come on.
Right then, Barcelona sauntered up to St James's Park, didn't they? And they almost paid for it. Harvey Barnes was very nearly the hero, only for a last-gasp penalty from Lamine Yamal to deny Eddie Howe's side a famous first-leg victory. Given the magnitude of the match, we did record an extra Tyne Matchday podcast with the boy wonder, Jacob Whitehead, making an appearance back on Tyneside. The game was deemed just too big and too potentially emotional for George Corgan.
Oh, come on.
Which you can listen to with a subscription. Go to podonthetyne.supportingcast.fm. If you want to listen to that. Now, listen, chaps, if you'd offered me 1-1 before the game, I genuinely would have took your hand off for that. If you'd offered me 1-1 and told me what was going to play out and that we were going to go ahead and then concede a penalty in injury time, I would have told you to politely shove it. It was one of those, wasn't it? It's one of those nights where it's hard. It felt like a loss walking away from the stadium, George. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I was watching it on the screen. It was incredibly deflating right at the end there, but overall, you know, I thought that was a stunning performance. There's a big asterisk next to the word stunning because we're not talking about a complete team. We're talking about a patchwork team. We're talking about a team that's played all of these games. You know, it's unfinished. You know, you can see that on the pitch. You see who lines up, you see who's starting, see who's not there. Bruno, their most important player, is not playing. It's very much an unfinished team, but if I can then borrow from the Verve, that was an unfinished symphony. I just thought they were excellent. You know, like with all the limitations that we know that have been, with all of the context that there's been this season, I just thought that was a truly wonderful performance. And yeah, the end was deflating. But a little while later, I only feel positive about that experience and about that performance and taken great heart from it. It was a shame. The interesting thing, I don't think 1-0 would be enough to win it at the Nou Camp. So, I mean, of course it changes things. Of course I would have preferred it to have been 1-0. I'm not going to say anything stupid. But in some ways, I don't think that's a calamitous result. I think Newcastle would have had to go to Spain and win anyway, or try to win, and they still do. But I just think it was a brilliant performance, I thought, with all the context there was.
It's interesting that you say you would have taken 1-1 before the game, Taylor, because I thought afterwards, Hansi Flick, Barcelona head coach, came out and said that if you'd asked me before the game for a 1-1, I'd have been happy. We have no excuses. Okay. I think Barcelona see it as a decent result, certainly in the context of the match itself. And I think the way that Hansi Flick set up, he gave Newcastle quite a lot of respect. I thought that he was almost, it wasn't like Barcelona really went for it. It was, let's try and make sure that we don't really lose the tie at St James's Park and then take back to the Camp Nou and obviously have confidence there. I slightly disagree with George in that I think that 1-0... Newcastle go there and probably still aren't favourites, but I think have a very, very good chance of going through because Barcelona would have to have come at them a little bit more. Newcastle's game plan that they're going to have of catching them on the break, I think would have suited them. Still, I still think they have a puncher's chance. This is what I said on the Extra Time podcast, but it does change a complex. And I also just think it gives Barcelona such a lift that they had the goal right at the very end to have snatched that away from Newcastle. I think that in so many ways it feels deflating, but even so, it was reassuring to hear Harvey Barnes and others within the camp talk about the fact that they are still taking the positives from this and that they see the first 90 plus 3 minutes rather than those last 2 minutes of added time.
But I don't know. Like, again, I'm going to just say the same thing. I would have preferred 1-0. So, of course, I would have preferred that by a long, long shot. But do you not think there's something sort of a bit interesting psychologically about that? That if you go there with 1-0, you're thinking about protecting that lead. And I don't think Newcastle can do that. I don't think they can do that.
Yeah.
That's an interesting point.
You know, we know that they can't keep a clean sheet. So, as we saw again last night. So, that this sort of means that they have to go there with the, you know, I don't think they can do what they did last night and swarm all over Barcelona at the start. I'm not sure that'll be the game plan, you know, and you would expect Barcelona to be better. I mean, Barcelona's home record is absolutely phenomenal. They've not lost a game in La Liga this season at home. And, I mean, they've scored, I can't remember what it is, but it's off the top of my head, it's something like they've scored 40 goals, they conceded 6 or something. It's like something ridiculous like that. So it was already a tall order. But I don't know. I think sort of in some ways it means that they won't go there with that mentality that they have to protect. They have to set up, you know, to defend and to protect what they have. There has to be a different formula for what they do. And so I just don't think it's disastrous is all I'm saying.
The word that kept coming to me during the game was that Newcastle were being very brave. I know they were at home and you would expect them to be on the front foot. But Chris, I thought bravery was the theme of the day. They were going for it. They were pushing Barcelona back when they had goal kicks and when they had possession at the back. They were playing in a way that they actually went toe-to-toe with one of the big boys of European football.
Yeah, and I think it was the opposite of arguably the second half against Manchester City at the weekend when maybe Newcastle were mentally and physically fatigued, but also the second half against Barcelona in September when they allowed Barcelona to just pass it around. Newcastle made sure that Barcelona never really got into a full rhythm. There were a couple of moments where Barca had a decent 5 or 10 minutes, but Newcastle wrestled back that momentum. They made sure that they went back on the front foot and forced mistakes or forced Barcelona deep, didn't let them really build up. And yeah, what it was brave, and that's what exactly what they needed. So if they were, Howe said before the match that Newcastle were going to have to be better than they'd been all season if they were going to have a chance of winning. I think it's arguable that in many ways they were potentially not in the final third, which I think was probably the issue. But beyond that, I think in all other areas of the pitch, I think Newcastle probably did match levels that they've shown at certain points in other games at stages this season. They didn't let their energy drop, that despite all of the matches they've played, they didn't let the concentration drop until the 90 plus fourth minute, and they also stuck rigidly to a game plan which clearly had potential benefits against that Barcelona high line. It was just a shame that maybe execution, decision making in the final third did let them down.
George, you mentioned the patchwork team. The selection was interesting. Anthony Gordon misses out due to this illness that's been ravaging the squad. Alan Shearer didn't seem best pleased in the build-up. He said if he can be on the bench and play 20 minutes at the end, then really he should be starting. If he's ill, he shouldn't be there whatsoever.
Yes, he also said old school, which of course he is. Grumpy old man, just, you know, man after my own heart, of course. Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, I was a bit perplexed by that, but Eddie Howe said afterwards, didn't he, that Gordon, that they did a training session in the morning, that Gordon didn't feel right, he didn't take part in it. And so that then formed the basis of his decision. And then he kind of praised the medical team for getting him ready to be on the bench. I suppose the risk is you start somebody who is ill and has to come off after 20 minutes, 25 minutes, you disrupt things from the start.
Yeah.
At least with, you know, the way Newcastle went about it, they had a plan and could stick to it. And then Gordon comes on and actually had a bit of an impact. I mean, it's a bit unusual, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I think it was, I mean, maybe it was Jacob, someone at the game also said this to me. And I do get it. And if he is really ill, then he wouldn't have been on the bench. But if someone has been lacking energy because they've been ill throughout the week,
yeah,
I can see the point, and I agree with George. You start him, and clearly if they knew he wasn't going to last more than 25, 30 minutes, it would be very strange to start him, yeah, and then hook him after 30 minutes. But if he says to you, I think I can come on and give you maybe a third of a match here,
yeah,
then having him on the bench is an option. And if it turns out in the second half he doesn't have the energy, if he says I'm not right, then he doesn't come on and somebody else comes on. You've got enough substitutes allowed for that to be the case, I think.
And obviously we're talking about team selection. I have to make this point again. I know it was made on extra time, and it was made on the television coverage as well. The discussion in team selection was, can you risk Anthony Gordon or do you play Osula, and of course the £120 million elephants in the room, double elephants, are the two guys on the bench who don't come on the pitch. I mean, it's astonishing, and that's what I mean when you're talking about this patchwork team, unfinished team, that your decision is whether you play a converted left winger up front or whether you play a very, very raw forward who's only started one game in the Champions before. That was the week before against Karabag, or the 2 weeks before against Karabag.
One Premier League start for Newcastle.
And
as well.
One Premier League start. And, you know, Eddie Howe was right. He was the best option that they had for what they wanted to do, which was to use that phenomenal pace and running and pressing. And, I thought everyone played their part. So everyone played well. But that, you know, that pace and that running and pressing was a vital component, and the other two just wouldn't be able to do it. I mean, you know, it's really astonishing. You take a step back again, it's astonishing that for what, you know, the game that Eddie Howe calls the biggest in Newcastle's history or modern history, the players that you've spent all that money in don't figure at all.
Yes. Well, Chris, the best young player in the world kept Lamine Yamal quiet all night, didn't he?
Yeah, this was quite the battle between Lewis Hall and Lamine Yamal. Lewis Hall, who'd had a very good battle with Savinho at the weekend as well, I think for half an hour, gave as good as he got, and then Savinho probably got the better of him and Newcastle, Man City generally did after that point, whereas he was exceptional against Barcelona. And I am someone who, in recent weeks, I've made this point to George, I made it to Jacob last night. I think that there's been, every time Hall's played and done something positive, I think people have waxed lyrical, and I get that, but I felt it was a little bit like when Sandro Tonali was going through his purple patch last year. Regardless of how they may have actually played, everyone would come out and say they were brilliant. But I think, unquestionably, he was absolutely superb against Barcelona. He had Yamal up against him, and a couple of times Yamal tried to go past him, couldn't. Then Yamal also has the incident, which we'll come on to in a second, I'm sure, where he basically runs into him off the ball very cynically and does not get booked, which would have meant if he had been booked, he would have been suspended for the return leg. But Hall was positive in everything he did with the ball. You could see there was quite often Newcastle played this crossfield pass from Malik Chow across to Hall early on to then get Hall onto the ball to try and play it in behind the back line. That was quite clearly a ploy. Move it wide quickly, spread play it, and then get it forward. And Hall was the one who was capable of doing that. But also, he dribbled well and then defended with such discipline. And yeah, he was interviewed leading up to the game. He was the player Newcastle put up, and he didn't seem overawed by the prospect of facing Yamal. He was very polite and very respectful, but just basically talked about himself, and he kept on referring to his own journey and where he's come from. You think, go back 2 years, he played one Champions League match, which was away at Borussia Dortmund, and he was hooked after 45 minutes. He was basically deemed unselectable. 2 years on, and he was Newcastle's standout player in an almost victory over Barcelona at home.
Hooked at halftime in three of his first four performances for Newcastle, and you're wondering at that point, like, how much have Newcastle agreed to pay Chelsea? And, you know, like, in that first season of his, would that actually happen? Could Newcastle get out of it? All of those sorts of things. I mean, you know, his progress, the scale, the ascent of his progress has just been out of this world. I think Chris is contrary and about Lewis Hall a little bit. I mean, I know what you mean. I think people do look at it and say, you know, he does one good thing. I think, you know, we're all guilty of that. Somebody does one good thing in a match, if you're a certain player and everyone says how great you are, whereas others don't get the same sort of treatment. But I do think he's been really, really good. I mean, you know, last season and this season, I think Lewis Hall has just been astonishing. But, you know, that game against Barcelona, he's taken it up another level. I mean, he was fantastic. I mean, he was fantastic. Run out of superlatives for him, really.
I mean, there are parts of his game that still need to be improved. Obviously, there's things that he can improve on. But you look at his age and you look at what he's done so far in his Newcastle career, and you just think, my God, the ceiling for this kid is so high.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, he was asked in the pre-match press conference. And he basically said that he was conscious of the price tag when he came in. He knew how much was being paid for him, or committed to be paid for him, because it was actually a loan with an obligation to buy for him having not played that many games. And he talked about dark moments and having to push through and come through that time and having worked hard, and the coach has really stuck by him. But it was also interesting. So in the press conference, for both Eddie Howe and Hall in the lead up to the game, Barcelona press were across. A lot of Barcelona press travel. There's a lot more for these Champions League press conferences anyway at St. James's Park as they're held. And there was some of them just talk, some of the Barcelona media just talking throughout Lewis Hall's press conference, basically ignoring. One of them took a phone call.
I read about this. Is that not because they're reporting live?
No.
As it's going on?
One of them answered a phone call. His phone went off and he answered.
Hello! I'm in a press conference!
Dom Jolly, yeah.
And then some of them were sitting, they were to my right. I wasn't actually directly next to them, but I could hear them. And the people who were directly next to them said, yeah, they were just basically sitting deep in conversation, turning almost away from the press conference that was going on. And it was sort of, it's been maybe conflated, but seen as just this complete lack of respect that maybe Barcelona had for this tie, and that people saw it as the ideal tie for Barcelona because they avoided PSG, they avoided all Real Madrid and all the sort of big guns going into this match. And I think that you felt that almost with Barcelona in the way that they should. I mean, there was a lot of stuff. I didn't watch the warm-up that closely, but I spoke to a few people who did, and some of the people who were reporting for British radio, and they were talking about how Barcelona just didn't seem that bothered, didn't seem really up for it. And I thought during the game itself, it didn't feel like it was that Barcelona ever really arrived at what was clearly a massive occasion for Newcastle. And it wasn't a massive occasion for Barcelona in their history, but they didn't match Newcastle in any of that. They didn't emotionally match them. They didn't physically match them. Just in no way did Barcelona really arrive at St. James's Park in the same way that Newcastle did.
I'll tell you what, if I was Eddie Howe, I would be pinning that press conference up on the dressing room wall.
How would you pin a press conference on a dressing room wall?
I mean, that's going to take a lot of thought. It's going to take a lot of thought, but that's what I'd be doing.
I don't think we have the technology to do that, George.
I think we can do anything with AI these days and 3D.
Excellent.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Chris, there was a bit of anger at that refereeing performance again, wasn't there? But was it justified?
Well, I'm going to be George.
Here he comes.
Said that I'm Mr. Contrarian.
Here he is.
if we listen back to, not just this podcast, if you listen back to any of the last, say, 6 weeks, any coverage of Newcastle games, the referee will have been mentioned in just about every single one of them afterwards. And here, I think we all need to stop doing that because the referee is there for both sides. You may argue there's for one or the other. So I think we need to. But also, I get that there were some moments, and the Yamal one is the key one. He probably should have been booked. But there were other moments for Newcastle and for Barcelona where it was clear bookings in the first 30 minutes and he let them go.
He did.
I know Tonali was the first one who was booked and that annoyed a lot of people. But he had let a lot go by that stage. And also, the penalty, the people talk about, oh, he added too much time on. It's the penalty, he actually goes down 20 seconds after the fourth minute has passed. Newcastle have made a substitution during that time. There's also been other incidents. He also, in the moment before Newcastle score, he basically tells Araujo that he has to go off the pitch, and then he doesn't get on the pitch in time to be able to cover Harvey Barnes. He's strong in that moment. So I am not saying that by any stretch of the imagination he was a wonderful refereeing performance, but I don't think you can turn around and say that Newcastle didn't win because of the referee. I just don't think it was one of those nights. It wasn't like a couple of the recent games.
It's also a minimum of 4 minutes. It's never, you know, it's never supposed to be exactly 4 minutes. But so I don't. Yeah, I mean, I hate the whole kind of like conspiracy thing that it's like, oh yeah, here we go again. It's like, you know, Newcastle being punished at the hands of big clubs, and you know, the referee didn't book Yamal because, you know, nobody
there was another one as well,
so
wasn't
suspended.
There was the Fermín López one as well, which should have been a yellow card, which I thought was more of a yellow card than the Yamal one.
Yeah,
to be honest,
I don't think that was like a travesty of a refereeing performance. And I totally agree with Chris. I mean, it's like he set a very high bar for yellow cards early on, and then at some point you sort of have to give one, and you then kind of make that, and so then once you've given one, it's like, well, why didn't you give one for that? Why didn't you give one for that? I think you know, the challenge on Hall, I think that was a yellow card challenge, but you know, like every single decision look over kind of with a microscope. Yeah, I don't, and it was a clear penalty at the end. That's not a travesty either. I don't think it was a dreadful refereeing performance. I mean, could you say that Newcastle didn't have luck run for them? Maybe a little bit.
Probably, yeah. And I get that. And you can, if you go through every single incident, maybe they were slightly more for Barcelona than Newcastle. But it's like I saw some people conflating it. Well, talking about being similar to PSG sort of situation. It just wasn't. It was not like that.
No.
The handball penalty for Livramento or anything like that. It just wasn't that sort of level.
No.
Yeah, I did think the Araujo thing was hilarious, though, I have to be honest. When he was dragging his arse back onto the pitch, I thought, I've only ever seen that once before. And that was when the dog did it in the sitting room on the rug. And then the ref told him to get off like a naughty schoolboy. Yeah. It was great fun. I really enjoyed that.
Just to go back, if you're saying it, you know, I think you can say it's a travesty. I think it's a travesty in some ways that Newcastle don't end up with a win from that very, very fine performance.
Yeah.
Really good performance, deserved to win. And it's, you know, it feels like heartbreak. It doesn't feel like it's justified, but not because of the referee.
Chris, you wanted to single out Jacob Ramsey.
Yeah, I thought he was excellent, and you've seen a lot of that recently, but it's just the way that it came up against a side who, in September, second half, and Frankie de Jong was not available for this, but Frankie de Jong and Pedri just took control and passed Newcastle to death, and it was like an exhibition of football. And Newcastle didn't give Barcelona a single inch, but Ramsey shows such bravery on the ball. He takes it on the turn, he carries it, he's quite happy to receive possession when they're under a lot of pressure. And I think you can maybe question sometimes his decision-making when he gets into the final third. There were a couple of moments where he shot when possibly he shouldn't or didn't play the ball as early as he could. But in that middle third, and for what Newcastle needed, and particularly when they haven't got Bruno Guimaraes, I just thought that he really has stepped up, and you can see exactly why Newcastle wanted him. There's a lot of talk about, oh, he's just an athlete a few months ago. Why have Newcastle just signed another athlete? You've seen in recent weeks that he has so much more to his game than that.
At that back four, they worked their socks off as well, George, didn't they? I thought Dan Byrne v Robert Lewandowski was a particular highlight. It was some battle. Resulted in the Polish striker getting hooked around about 70 minutes. Absolute rock meeting a hard object, I believe. That's not even the real phrase, is it? But that's what I've gone with.
Yeah, no, it's like a lighthouse meeting a
yes.
Godzilla.
Good, yeah.
I thought it was meat and drink, really, to Dan Byrne and, you know, that physical challenge. Absolutely came out on top. Lewandowski didn't really have a sniff, I didn't think. But, you know, you're talking about huge performances across the pitch. Again, Trippier, I thought, you know, his leadership was superb. And Chow had a good game, apart from dangling his foot out for the penalty.
Yeah. Chris, I thought Newcastle tactically for 94 minutes were as good as they've been this season. Barca were very, very high at times, weren't they? Newcastle got in behind them a number of times, but they just couldn't get that final ball right.
Yeah, the game plan was ideal, and I thought they executed all of it really well until the final ball or the final decision-making. Asula had chances, Alanga had the one across goal, which was flagged offside. May have, if it actually gone in and Garcia hadn't saved it, may have just been onside, possibly. Barnes hits the post. They had the opportunity to have a lot of balls flashed across the box from Alanga as well. But yeah, just that final decision making wasn't quite
but
there.
But also,
largely it was a clever setup and well executed until that point.
I think you're right about Alanga, but a couple of those balls that he whipped into the box actually were really, really good. And it wasn't so much the final ball, it was nobody there to meet it. You haven't got somebody sniffing around the 6-yard box in the danger area, wanting to stick his head out or foot out or whatever. And that is the problem. But that's the problem that Newcastle have got, isn't it? But, I mean, I thought some of those balls in were encouraging. I thought Alanga was decent. And, you know, we'll talk about the goal, I'm sure. But that Jacob Murphy ball in for the goal was just great. You know, it's just brilliant.
Yes, Harvey Barnes got player of the match and another goal under his belt as well, Chris. He was busy, wasn't he? I thought he deserved that goal at the end. It was good.
He was busy. I mean, I don't think he was... I wouldn't have given player of the match. I mean, for that big moment, yes, but I didn't think he was necessarily Newcastle's best player, but he took the decisive moment. Actually, probably one of his worst finishes he's had as well, because it was straight at the keeper.
Probably scuff, wasn't it?
Yeah, scuff, and he was really unlucky with the one that hit the post, but he was there, he'd gambled, he got himself into the box, into that 6-yard box when Newcastle hadn't had forwards there in the passing, and yeah, got that big moment.
Added time, the penalty, and that question of mentality raises its head yet again, George. On Amazon Prime, Alan Shearer said they were naive, but Wayne Rooney said they were right to try and go and get a second. What do you think?
Well, so, I mean, if my mentality is anything to go by, I was screaming for the referee to, in spite of what I've already said, I was screaming for the referee to blow his whistle, and I was screaming for Newcastle to take it into the corner. But I do think that's an interesting debate. I don't think Newcastle were guilty of sort of extreme naivety at that point. I don't think 1-0 would have been enough, as I said at the start. So I think that idea of going for a second was okay. I don't think they were sort of being suicidal, kamikaze. I don't think it was that sort of attacking. But if you could replay it now, then of course, yeah, you do take it to the corner. You try not to give the ball away. You do all of those basic things. I don't think it was some of the really bad game management we've seen at other points this season. I don't know what Chris thinks, but I wasn't sort of dismayed by what Newcastle were doing in the build-up. There was an interesting debate, wasn't there, when a little bit earlier, where Byrne is asking whether he should go forward for a set piece, and Howe is saying yes, definitely go forward. So that was, you know, that sort of that argument was being played out on the pitch. Obviously, in retrospect, you would be solid and take the 1-0. But I didn't think there was negligence on Newcastle's behalf in the way that they were playing.
No, I mean, Joe Linton went ballistic at Gordon, having gone ballistic at Ramsdale in the first half for booting the ball long when he could have gone short. But he went ballistic at Gordon for trying to play a Tonali in behind in the night. I think it was the third minute of added time. But Newcastle actually got back into shape after that. And it was, the frustration was they gave away a silly foul, really, Willock. And I know the play had got beyond him, but I didn't think he needed to foul him necessarily. He was running towards bodies. And then Newcastle just didn't defend that final moment very well. And that probably is mental and physical fatigue again, but it's the 15th goal Newcastle have conceded in the 80th minute onwards in all competitions this season. It's now, they've kept 3 clean sheets in 32 games. They've kept none in the last 14. Even when they're in a match where they don't look like they're going to concede a goal, they are still finding a way to concede. And as harsh as that is, that's what's costing them. And that's why they feel like an early team this season, that they did have that moment right at the very end. As harsh and as assessment as that is, I think that's just the reality you've got to mention.
Well, Hope Springs Eternal, Sammy NUFC on Blue Sky said, when Newcastle are raging and have nothing to lose, we play like we're the best team in the world. We really could go there and win. I think we should leave it on that.
I'll tell you, honestly, I will love it if we beat them. Love it.
Right then, the Lasses return, almost a month to the day without a match for the Lasses. They're back in action against Sheffield United on Saturday, their third bottom of the WSL. Next 3 games are on the same day as the men play as well. That's happened a lot this season. It seems particularly daft after such a gigantic break. Tanya Oxtoby's side are 5th, 3 points behind 2nd place Birmingham City, and 2 behind 3rd place Crystal Palace, who occupy the final playoff promotion spot. We'll play those two teams back-to-back after Sheffield. This is really a crucial spell, isn't it? And George, you spoke to Gemma Purfield about the Lasses' promotion ambitions and their aim for the run-in.
Yeah, I did. Gemma had a tough time at the start of her career at Newcastle, immediately getting injured. But she's committed to the team, been really good. And yeah, now is absolutely the business end of the season. Can Newcastle pick it up and finish in style? And yeah, sit back and have a listen to this long chat with her that I had not too long ago.
Look, we're really excited going into this next part of the season. Obviously, we felt like we're picking up quite good momentum with the last 2 wins, and would have loved to probably carry on playing, but the international break's come and it also gives us a lot of time now to get players back fit, back on the pitch, get our squad even bigger than it's been. And obviously a bit of a change of scenery for those going on international. So I know that we'll be ready for this next run-in, but we're excited. I think we know that it's in our hands and we can do everything in our power to make sure that we get promoted at the end of this season. And like you say, 3 points is the difference. So we know we've got Birmingham in a couple of weeks as well in that game in hand. So that'll be really important.
Yeah, I mean, that idea of kind of getting everyone together and working with them, it's quite an interesting one because we're in March, but this has been such a challenging season, I suppose, in lots of ways, but a season of change. You signed lots of players in the summer, including yourself, signed more players in January, different manager. How valuable might this spell without a game actually be in terms of getting everyone together?
Yeah, I think these breaks are really important. They're not a break to just take your foot off the gas. They're actually a break to come together, work on things you want to, build relationships on the training pitch and kind of embed those that we've brought in January, keep working on what we've been working on previously under Tanya and since she's come in, because obviously we've developed our play and our style of play and things, which I think the fans will see. So yeah, we want to keep building on all the things we're good at and making sure that our relationships keep building to put us in the best position possible going into the next 3-game week.
This isn't a kind of blindingly original statement, but this is a big season for everybody in this division, isn't it? Because of the opportunity that's there with the extra promotion places.
Absolutely. I think that we've been asking for a league expansion for a long time. It's what we've wanted. There's been multiple teams the last few years in the Championship that could have gone up, and the gap's been tight. The league's been tight, and we've known that. So I think everyone this year has gone for it and put a push to get promoted. Obviously, us being one of them. We're really kind of excited by that. We're not shying away from what we've got to do. And like I say, it's up to us. It's in our control. So as long as we keep taking each game as it comes and making sure that we're focused on our task in hand and blocking out the outside noise, like, we're more than capable of achieving it.
This is something that I've been kind of asking people around the club consistently over the past 18 months or so. Is this club ready to take that step, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I've been at quite a few clubs, and I think when you see the backing that we've got, and you know, we've gone through a facility change, we've gone through a manager change, we've come through a lot of player recruitment. There's been so many changes, but all moving us in the right direction, of course. And I think we know that this club's ready. Everything we do each day is to prepare us to be ready to play in the WSL, and our standards, we want to keep at a WSL level, so the shock's not big for us. But yeah, of course we're ready. That's what the club's been building towards for the last 3 years. And yeah, hopefully we make that happen.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, you've played at that level, so you know what it's like, and you know what it takes. Obviously, the Newcastle story has kind of been beautiful. It's been brilliant seeing the team go up through the divisions and embrace professionalism, all of that kind of stuff. Why is it? So we've all seen that story. Why is it ready? Why does it compare with the other teams that you've been at, or how?
I think just putting their words into action. For example, we're in a new training facility that is ours, you know, and that was said to me when I came in, and that's been delivered. So that's fantastic, because a lot of times you can get told and sold something that's not there, and it's happened. We've got our own facility. We're on our own schedule, our own time, which is massive. But I think just the direction in terms of where the club want to be and what they're pushing towards, I think you see that in terms of like the fans that we've got, even, you know, playing at St. James's in the derby, even down to our pre-season, going away to Marbella, going away to Bayern Munich. We put some great trips in place. So I think everything's building. We've brought in some great experience as well. You know, you've got Jordan coming in. You've got Morgan, obviously 2-time World Cup winner. Like, that shows ambition. These people are here for a reason, and they want to help us move up the table and get ourselves into the WSL.
Was that the kind of chief motivation for you when you signed?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I wanted to come here to win the league, get promoted. That was the whole vision behind it, and it aligned exactly with what I wanted. I want to be back in the WSL and back playing at that level. So this seemed like the perfect fit for that, and just seemed like a really like homely, friendly club to be at as well. Like, the Geordie fans are fantastic, we know that. And for me to be back up north after being down south for a little while, it was really nice. It's just got a home feel to it. So yeah, it was a no-brainer for me coming back.
You were the first signing of the summer, I believe. I mean, if we sort of think about this season as being epic for good reasons, but also sort of challenging reasons, it's definitely been an epic for you, because you have that horrible injury, and you have surgery, knee surgery. Talk me through what that was like. I mean, it must have been so frustrating for you.
It was, and it was probably one of the hardest parts of my career, to be honest, because I feel like I deal with change quite well. I've obviously played for numerous teams, and I'm quite happy to, you know, get to know people and slot in. But I think being isolated from the group in a way naturally that you are when you're injured was quite hard. But I have to give credit to obviously the staff and the players here who did make me feel at home and tried to get me as involved as possible. And I tried to build relationships with the girls off the pitch, although I couldn't maybe do it on the pitch. So yeah, it was really tough, but I think it gave me a little reflection period to work on things that I maybe don't have time to do normally, and just reframe myself. And I was more motivated than ever to come back into that team. And it was nice, because like I said, it was hard to build those relationships, but I actually had them then off the pitch. So when I stepped on the pitch for the first time with that team, I felt like I was already, it wasn't the first time, I felt like I'd been there forever. So yeah, and the team were fantastic. They were so supportive and celebrated every small win with me along the way. And gave me a big cheer when I was back on the pitch. So I think they're the little things you don't see, and it made it all worthwhile in the end.
When you say it gave you a chance to sort of do stuff you wouldn't normally have done, what kind of stuff do you mean?
I think focusing on like the little things in the gym, whether it's like strengthening your hamstrings, or whether it's balance work, or just those fine-tuning, those little bits that maybe go to the bottom of the pile when you're focusing on playing, winning and performance-based. So it gave me a chance to kind of take a step back, also just reframe where I'm at, what I want to achieve, and did some goal setting in that time as well, and made sure that when I came back, I was in the best place possible physically and mentally to come in and help the team.
Are you a good watcher?
Am I a good watcher? No. Awful. You know, I sat in the stands and I'm kicking every ball with the team. And yeah, but I think, do you know what was great? I was allowed to be a part of the team as much as I wanted to be, whether that was in the changing room before the game and hyping up the girls and giving feedback. Like, I like to obviously be as involved as possible. That's in my personality. I'm quite a people person. So I was more than happy to be in there and in around the girls and making sure that they felt positive and excited about the games and the training sessions, and letting them know how good they were and hyping them up where I could.
Do you feel like you're now back to full fitness? Obviously, you've been back in the team and playing very well. Do you feel like you're there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, I've got a few games on the bounce now, and I feel like each week I'm growing and getting better and better. And I think that's a huge positive when you're coming back from injury. I didn't feel kind of out of place coming back or anything, which is huge because we've got a very talented team and a talented squad. So yeah, to pull on a shirt and start for this club was massive, and it was a big milestone for me personally after the injury. And yeah, I feel like I'm back in and I'm ready to help the team get to the top. And I think that's the beauty of this team. We have so many talented players. We've got such a great squad, and we're going to need everyone to get it over the line.
Was there a sense of regret or disappointment that the manager who signs you is not there by the time you're able to make a positive impact on the pitch? I mean, that must be a source of sorrow for you a bit, I guess.
Yeah, of course. It was tough. I never got to play under Becky, and got to give her credit for the journey that she brought this club on and all the things she did for this football club. She was obviously fantastic and got the club to where it is now. Positively for me as well, I think I had worked with Tanya before as well, so it wasn't too much of a shock. So that kind of worked out quite nicely. Obviously, regret for Becky, and like I say, not undermining anything she did. She was fantastic to get the club here, but also on the other side of it, I have worked with Tanya before, so I think on a personal level, it was quite nice to see a familiar face in a manager as well, and show that they've got the trust in me as well.
Yeah, so that was going to be my next question. You have worked with her before. What was that experience like? What is she like? What kind of manager have Newcastle got?
We've got a fantastic manager in Tanya. I think she's experienced. She's got great football knowledge. I think tactically she's fantastic, and she's good at getting around the group, you know, getting to know people. And I think the other thing is she's got high standards. So it's a really good balance between knowing the line. She's got very high standards and you've got to perform, but at the same time knowing she knows where people at the end of the day and cares for us as well. So I think she's got the great balance of that.
And one of the reasons, or to put that a different way, when you signed, one of the things that Becky talked about was your leadership qualities. You were obviously captain at Southampton. What does leadership mean to you?
I think for me personally, I like to lead by example for a start. Like, I pride myself on professionalism and doing everything right. The 1%'s are big for me. So I think in my day to day, I live like a professional, whether I'm here or away from here. It is what I pride myself on. So I think leading by example is massive. But I also think like good communication with people and holding high standards, that's something that I also would pride myself on. I think I build relationships with people, so then you can have the difficult conversations, knowing it comes from a place of trust and care, and that you know that people can be better, but at the same time, equally just making people feel good about themselves and letting them know how good they are, and getting people to concentrate on their strengths sometimes, and not letting people forget that, yeah, how good they can be. So yeah, I think leadership to me is, of course, leading by example, but I also think being like someone people trust and being able to pick people up when they're down and tell people hard things when you maybe need them to pick it up. And I think that's kind of how I'd go about it. But I think building those relationships first is key.
You're part of the leadership group here, I think I'm right in saying. What does, I mean, so there's one of those with the men's team as well. And there's been a kind of lot of talk about that recently, because it's felt like the senior players have kind of really stepped forward in a moment of need. What do you actually do as a leadership group? What does that mean? What are your responsibilities?
I think kind of like we said, holding standards, keeping standards high. Obviously, just a bit of a bridge between the staff and the players at times. So if there's things that the staff might feel they want to get across, but doesn't need to be a big thing, or anything from the player's side that we think, oh, we could maybe change and address that. So it's just an honest and open communication really between staff and players. And I think, yeah, the main thing is us holding high standards and making sure we're bringing everyone along on the journey with us, because it is going to be a squad effort to get us to the end of the season. So yeah, I think that's the main consensus of the leadership.
Have you fallen in love with Newcastle a bit?
Have a little bit, yeah. I say a little bit, a lot. I love the city. I love the fans. I love what the club stands for. I think it's such a hard-working football club that play nice football at the same time, and that fits with exactly how I see the game. So yeah, I love Newcastle. I think it's a fantastic city, a fantastic football club, and an unrivaled fan base there.
Gets under the skin, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It really gets into you early. So yeah.
Good. And what is the ceiling for this team? I mean, I don't want to put pressure on, but I mean, we all know what the ambition for the team, for the club is, but what do you think?
Obviously the immediate one is promotion, of course. And then when we're promoted, we've got to stay there. You've seen it's a tough league when you go up, and that's been kind of shown over previous years. We need to get there and stay there, and that's why it's so important now that we operate at a WSL level, so it's not a shock. And then the sky's the limit. I think the club wants to go Champions League football, of course, and want to start producing international players from everywhere, signing young English talent that are going to come through and play for the Lionesses. And I think, yeah, the club's got everything it needs to be a top club and be up there with the Man City, Arsenal, Chelsea of the world. So I think, yeah, that's the ambition. And I think the club can absolutely do it. The sky's the limit. But one step at a time, we need to make sure we get promoted first. Every day matters, whether that's in the gym, whether that's on the training pitch. Our prep's important to make sure that this next run of games is in our favour, and we know it's in our hands. So yeah, we're looking forward to it. We're excited and we're ready for what the rest of the season has to hold.
Right then, we've discussed Barcelona at length, and there's a mouth-watering return leg next week, but there is the small matter of Chelsea away in between. Let's be honest, Chris, Newcastle's league record there is pretty lamentable, isn't it?
Yes, I'm going to refer to our friends at NUFC.com here, whose second paragraph in previewing this game says, 30 visits in this competition have harvested just 10 points from a possible 90, with 7 draws and 1 victory, the latter thanks to the famous Papi Cissé brace in 2012.
Absolutely.
So, another away ground at one of the so-called Big Six, which Newcastle have a pretty appalling record at. Not massively encouraging in that regard, Newcastle's away form in general, still only 3 Premier League wins away from home all season. But Chelsea play tonight, as we were speaking, Wednesday night against PSG. They also play Tuesday. So whereas Newcastle had this ridiculously tight run of fixtures last week, it's Chelsea who have that now going into this weekend. And although they have a very deep squad and can make a lot of changes, maybe Newcastle can be slightly fresher and take advantage of that.
George, do we think Eddie Howe will rotate for the league and maybe prioritise the Champions League? Should he do that? Could we see Wissam Waldemada?
Well, to slightly turn that around, I mean, I think he has to play his absolute strongest lineup, what he deems to be the strongest lineup for Barcelona. I mean, I think that's just a no-brainer. I just think, that's a sort of transformative match, a potentially transformative match. Now, if Newcastle go out of the Champions League, obviously it only leaves them with the Premier League, and I'm not dismissing that. It's really important that Newcastle get themselves back up the table. But yeah, I would expect there to be some changes for Chelsea. Some players need some minutes, whether it is the likes of Waldemada or Wissa. What do you do? How do you, what do you do with them? Brilliant seeing Livramento back, by the way, over the past kind of couple of games. Got more minutes against Barcelona as well. Does he play in the second match? I don't know. But, I think there are a few options there. They've got to give some bodies a bit of a rest. I thought that worked well against Barcelona. And of course, then there's Gordon, who didn't start. What do they do with him?
And Chris, the Premier League is still Newcastle's best route back into Europe, isn't it? Although there is a debate among fans as whether it's wise to qualify for a lesser UEFA competition.
Yeah, Newcastle are 5 points behind 7th-placed Brentford with 9 games remaining. that is a gap that can be bridged, but there are also four teams in between them and Brentford too, and Newcastle haven't really had consistent form. If they go out of the Champions League, you could argue their Premier League form may well pick up because they'll be better rested and have more time on the training field. But finishing high in the Premier League just in purely financial terms will bring them greater money, although getting through the quarterfinals of the Champions League is also extremely lucrative. I also think the debate among fans is, yeah, do they want to be in the Conference League in particular next season, which is maybe what they would get into, depending on how domestic cup competitions work, who qualifies for what. But at least some at the top of the club think that it's to the benefit, certainly revenue-wise, in pure revenue terms, for Newcastle to be in the Conference League, even though financially, prize money-wise, it's worth, I think, about a tenth of the Champions League. You have to bear in mind that Newcastle would have a lot of home matches where they could also bring in revenue in that regard, and moving to the new SCR model and also UEFA's financial models, it would be to their benefit to have greater revenue. So footballing-wise, maybe not ideal, but financially, at least, I think it is preferable for at least some of the club that they get back into that.
Players want to be in Europe. I mean, obviously, the Champions League is the be-all and end-all, but being able to offer European football to players is important. If it was the Conference League, it would theoretically allow Newcastle to rotate much more efficiently and effectively and in, you know, widespread terms. You know, they've got a chance this summer to change the squad, you know, to make it deeper, to make it better equipped for it. It just hasn't been, but there just haven't been those opportunities to have a gimme game here and there where you can do that rotation. If they get into Europe, it also means it's mission accomplished for this season. It was, you know, that is effectively minimum target for this season, and it means that they can say that they've hit that. Newcastle want to be a club who are playing in Europe season in, season out. They have to get used to it. They have to get better at it. And there's no debate about it in my mind. It would also be a competition that they would have a good chance of winning, I would argue.
Right then, chaps, just before we finish off, let's move on and have a quick chat about ticket prices. There have been rises at several Premier League clubs, but ours are pretty steep, certainly for some fans inside the stadium, Chris.
Yeah, as I said, some of the premium bars, it's gone up 15%. Elsewhere, it's gone up 5%. Inflation in the UK has been about 3% year on year, so it isn't above inflation rise. It's the fourth year in a row there's been 5% rises. For those who were on previously long-term price holds from the which were legacy of the Mike Ashley era, which ended at the start of last season, they've had that rise then plus these rises on top of it to deal with cost of living crisis, the likes of what's going on at the moment. It seems that oil, energy prices, everything is going to go up as well, and this is on top of that. David Hopkinson did say when he was at our live show, he basically was upfront about the fact that ticket prices would rise. He has been transparent on this. He put his name to a statement that came out with this, and in previous years that hasn't necessarily always happened. Darren Eales did do it sometimes, so I'm not trying to dig them out, but he has put his name to it at other clubs. It's just sort of a faceless and nobody is can be held accountable. He's been transparent about that. He's been upfront, but he has also, as other clubs have talked about, revenue, PSR, SCR, and I think that is just, I think it's a dangerous precedent that almost the reason that we need to, a club which is theoretically owned by, well, which is owned by theoretically one of the wealthiest owners in the world, could spend that money if they were allowed to, but instead they have to justify what they spend by bringing in increased revenue, and that means the ticket prices can be raised. It feels like a bit of an excuse. It feels like a bit of a strange way for that to be moved. So I understand why a lot of people have not been supportive of this, why they think that the rises shouldn't be there. At least Newcastle have been upfront about it, but that's not me defending it, because I think that some of the moves, like the reduction in the size of the family enclosure, that seems like a bit of a... I don't think that's necessarily the best move possible. I get that it's probably going to bring in more money, but it feels like that is an important area where you bring in the next generation of fans, and also the disability discount for season ticket holders has also been reduced, and that just feels... The talk is that it brings it in line with the Premier League clubs, but that just... I don't know, it just doesn't feel like it's an entirely necessary move, but that's just my opinion on it. I'm not saying that as someone speaking actually from the club. I'm sure they would argue there are reasons for it, but I think a lot of people in the sound will be frustrated.
Is it the fourth year in a row that there's been 5% minimum? So you're talking about 20% over 4 years, and that is too much. And, you know, I think this ownership, they've talked about this before. I mean, when Mehrdad Gudusi, I think he was on one of their committees looking at ticket prices, and his opinion was that Newcastle had an opportunity to do something very different, to not increase ticket prices. This isn't London. This isn't an affluent part of the world. I think supporters at our club, as well as elsewhere, know that they have to do their bit sometimes, and that's fair enough. But minimum 20% over 4 years is too much money, I think. I mean, I do appreciate the, I do appreciate the honesty from David Hopkins, and it's good that he's put his name to it. But I think fans are being asked to do too much. I hope that they look at that in the future.
I mean, when you put on top of that as well, all of the extra games in the Champions League, if Newcastle get back into Europe, all the extra cup games, all the travel involved for the lads and lasses who travel away with the club, it's an awful, awful lot of money. And I wouldn't begrudge anybody saying, this is too much for me, I can't afford this anymore,
The Champions League tickets themselves, I mean, they're wonderful occasions. They're, it's brilliant. Obviously, I'm devastated that I wasn't there for the Barcelona match. And, that is a game that will live long in the memory, but you're being asked to pay £70. It's just an enormous amount of money. And what is it that we want? What is it that we want from our stadium? It's for it to be noisy and full of rage, full of anger, full of hostility, and that's premium pricing. That is, and it's I think it's tough.
I would be interested to see what the margins are based on how much money this price rise is going to bring in compared to what a potential training ground sponsor or a potential training kit sponsor or something like that could potentially bring in further down the line. I know some fans have been saying, why can't they find this money from somewhere else? Why does it have to be taken out of the fans' pockets? And I completely understand that feeling. I don't know the specifics behind what the numbers are, but it does feel like they've been going on about these additional commercial revenue streams for a long time, and they just haven't came in yet.
Yeah, I think they are coming, but I think that the problem is that they haven't yet, and they would argue they need revenue from all areas, but the problem is, optics-wise, because they haven't been announced yet, and this comes first, I think the optics around it are even worse because of that as well.
Okay, fair enough. Right, then let's move on, chaps, and get finished off here. Reminder that you can subscribe to our Extra Time service for an additional episode each week, including Tuesday's Matchday Report from Newcastle Barcelona, featuring big match gate crasher Jacob Whitehead. There's a lower priced option as well for listening to the usual episodes completely advert free. Subscribe at podonthetyne.supportandcast.fm. Feel free to get in touch with us at podonthetyne@gmail.com and give us a follow on Twitter, X, and Blue Sky at podonthetyne. Thank you very much for your time, chaps. Thank you very much, George Corgan.
You're very welcome. What a joy to chat.
An absolute pleasure. And thank you as well, Chris Woff.
You're very welcome. I will be out in Barcelona next week, and hopefully Newcastle will be emptying themselves going for that victory.
Don't do that. That's it from Pod in the Time. Thanks a lot for listening, all of you out there. We'll be back in your ears very soon. Until then, take care. Goodbye.
Acting as spokesperson for the Geordie Nation and wearing the 1997 Newcastle kit. What an absolute five-star gilded treat.